Hello and welcome to Dialect. We're Bristol's first podcast set up in 2002 with a grant from the Scarman Trust. I'm Tony Gosling, and this week we look at the increasing voting fraud here in Britain and also the latest developments in fracking. Also, child stealing by the state. We start this week with Ian R. Crane, who's an expert in fracking. He's been involved right from the start in that campaign, and he's a former oil worker.
Okay, well, my name is Ian R. Crane, and actually my research into the UK voting system is something that has been sort of running in parallel with my other exposures that I've been working on, and of course, I mean, I think we're going to talk about it later, but for the last 3 years, 3.5 years now, I've been focused very much on the unconventional gas industry. But the voting issue is something that is still a great cause of concern, and in fact I ran a series of seminars around the country in the weeks immediately prior to the general election in May, flagging up my concerns about voter fraud and about the risk that the election was about to be rigged.
So that was the 2015 election, May 2015, yep, which the Conservatives won. A lot of people were very surprised. So what were you saying as part of those seminars? I'm fascinated to know, especially since you seem to have predicted that there would be an unexpected swing, and the Conservatives are the obvious potential culprits for having been involved in a certain amount of fixing of that election.
Well, I won't claim any credit for actually predicting the result, because I was making the observation that I really wasn't sure what the dark establishment actually wanted as a result. But I stated that my expectation was that they would get the result they wanted, and it would be through some fairly blatant vote fixing. And as you rightly say, the expectation was of a hung parliament, literally right up until close of the polls, or even beyond the close of the polls, the expectation was that it was going to be a hung parliament without any party having an outright majority. And so it was actually, I think, a shock to most commentators that to discover that the Tories had, in fact, achieved an outright majority. And what has been really quite interesting is the fact that there has been almost no attempt to do any detailed analysis of the breakdown of how the voting actually came together. And my prediction was that the way in which they would manipulate the outcome of the election would be through postal votes. And what is interesting is, as we speak, to the best of my knowledge, we still do not have the breakdown of the postal vote contribution in the 2015 election. Yet we have it for every other election, going back certainly to 1945.
Can you talk a bit about how those postal votes are fixed? I mean, I don't want to give an instruction manual here for political corruption and fraud, but I mean, you obviously have done a bit of homework as to how easy it is to fix these postal votes and how it's done.
Well, let me just give you a little bit of background, because some people are under the impression that postal votes are something that has been introduced literally in the last few years. That's not strictly true. But what is true is that we have never seen anything like the percentage of postal votes contributing to elections that we've seen since 2001. And if we go back to 1945, for example, I mean, there were 2 million postal votes in 1945. And obviously, that really reflects the fact that obviously there was a lot of servicemen, a lot of people in the military. And it was the end of the war. But, you know, there was not a lot of people hadn't been demobbed yet. So that was a very high percentage of postal votes. That was actually 4%. 4% of the total votes counted were postal votes in 1945. And then we look at every other election, right through and up to and including the 1997 election, which was when Tony Blair first came into office. And with the exception of the 1974 vote, which was the Ted Heath election, where there was about 3%, just under 3% of total votes were postal. But in every other election, it basically is give or take around the 2% marker. And in 2001, we see a massive leap, and it goes up to 5%. So the number of postal votes in 2001 doubled. Then in 2005, now 2005 was a very, very significant election because this was the first election after the invasion of Iraq. And the Blair government was extremely unpopular. And there was the very, very real risk that even if Labour got a majority, which was thought to probably be the case, but there was the risk that Tony Blair and Jack Straw, his foreign secretary, were likely not to be re-elected. And the postal votes in the 2005 election went up to over 12%. So, you know, from 3% in 2001 to over 12%, so quadrupled 2005. And I suspect that the Tories realised from that how easy it was to manipulate the postal votes, because the postal votes in Jack Straw's constituency and in Tony Blair's constituency, so Blackburn and Sedgefield respectively, were very, very high. In fact, in Blackburn, the total percentage of postal votes cast was 35%. I mean, this is just outrageous. You know, there is no way 35% of the electors in the Blackburn constituency voted by post. And to make sure that Tony Blair wasn't a dead duck prime minister, what they did, loaded the election with candidates. So you split all the opposition votes. So you make sure there's nobody there that really can mount a significant campaign against him. And the irony is that Tony Blair, at the height of his unpopularity, ended up with a bigger majority in 2005 than he actually achieved in 97 and in 2001, when he was extremely popular.
What about the use of this in marginals? Because that must be, you know, if you're looking at just, this is the crazy thing with our electoral system, the first past the post system, is just a few votes can make a massive difference. So even just maybe 10, a handful, 20, 30 postal votes can actually tip a constituency from one side to the other.
Most definitely. And that's why it's actually quite shocking that the postal vote statistics haven't been published yet, because I think that this is a classic case of, if you leave it long enough, if you kick the can down the road far enough, then by the time the information comes out, then basically everyone's really sort of forgotten about it. They've moved on and they're not going to go back and take a look at it. I mean, the guy that, in my opinion, should have been kicking up merry hell, not that I'm necessarily I'm apolitical per se, you know, Nigel Farage should have been kicking up merry hell after the result was announced in Thanet. I mean, there were some very, very interesting things that came out of the Thanet election. I mean, first of all, the local council was absolutely cleaned up by UKIP. I mean, it was a massive majority. They basically took the council You know, no one else had got anywhere close. Yet somehow Nigel Farage is beaten into second place. And of course, there were allegations of ballot boxes going missing. And I'll talk about that in a second, because this manipulation of ballot boxes, unfortunately, is something that we're hearing more and more about, basically since the responsibilities changed in terms of the way in which ballot boxes are transferred between the polling station and the returning office. But one, you know, another clue of the Thanet election, if we look at the last four elections, and of course, you know, some of these constituencies, they take great pride in how quickly they're able to manage their count or try and beat the time they achieved the previous election in getting the result announced. And in every single case, from 1997, 2001 and 2010, the Thanet result was all announced at around about between 3:15 and 3:30. Interestingly, the 2005 election, which was the very sensitive one for the then Labour government, the result was announced at 4:44. But this time round, the result wasn't announced until 11 a.m. So, you know, 8 hours later than the previous elections. And, you know, there's no...
Yeah, but surely, Ian, that could be just simply the need for recounts, that kind of thing.
No, there wasn't a recount. There wasn't a recount. That was simply, they, you know, there was just, well, there hasn't really been an explanation as to why that was the case.
Any conjecture as to why you think it may have taken so long?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, I wasn't in the returning office there, whether there were any shenanigans or not, you know, we don't know. But I mean, that for me was, there's too many signals there that would suggest that there should be an investigation. But, you know, for whatever reason, the establishment is very reluctant to do any deep probing into the postal vote system, because I think they know that if they probe deeply, they are going to uncover massive fraud. Now, you know, the way this, come back to your original question, I mean, basically the way it works is that anybody can request a postal vote. And interestingly, in the northeast of England, that's the highest percentage of postal votes in the country. And in fact, one of the Sunderland constituencies, they have 58% of their votes are now postal. And now, I'm not suggesting that there's any sort of manipulation up there, because they're all, you know, out and out Labour strongholds. There's no question that it's going to be Labour that get into these areas. But they seem to have gone through a cultural change over the last decade there, where effectively people are encouraged to vote by post. In the southeast of the country, well, not just the southeast, actually right across the south of England, it's the other end of the spectrum, and the average postal vote is around about 8.5%. In fact, the average right across the country, and I'm talking 2010 here because we don't have the statistics for 2015, but in 2010, the average right across the country was literally just shy of 19%. So, you know, a massive increase again from the 12% of 2005. But, you know, basically, the postal vote is there to aid people who, for varying reasons, would find it difficult to go physically cast their vote on polling day. So traditionally, that's the elderly, the disabled, people who are away on holiday or away on business. Then traditionally, they're the people that can apply for the postal votes. But what's been happening is there have been active campaigns to get people to register for postal votes. And in some cases, what we know has occurred is that people have registered on the electoral roll at an address where they're not living to get a postal vote. And there's very little check that's done. Once somebody makes an application to go on to the electoral roll, although the election registration officers are responsible for vetting the application, in reality, there really isn't a lot of vetting. So as over the last few years, what's happened is that manipulators within the parties, and I'm not suggesting that the party leadership is necessarily directly involved, but they will certainly suspect. And because if you know they perceive it to be working in their interest, then they turn the proverbial blind eye. So what once happened, of course, was that they would have runners, and you know, they would have people volunteering to drive the elderly and the infirm, you know, to the polling stations. Now they don't need to do that. They simply encourage them to register for a postal vote. And you know, one of the things that I suspect happened, for example, in Eastbourne, where we do know, thanks to the Conservative office there, we do know that 27% of the votes cast were postal votes. And many of those postal votes will have been from people who are in the care homes, because obviously Eastbourne has a very high density of care homes. Now, you know, the one thing that obviously we don't know is how many of those votes, of that 27% that originated from the care homes, were actually completed by the named individual, or whether they were completed and then returned by somebody else on their behalf.
Now, there's also the almost the capital in Britain of voting fraud seems to be Tower Hamlets in London.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there's now an investigation going on there. Again, one wonders how long it, you know, how long these things have to take before you get some proper information. And there's another, alongside all this, is a completely different process to register as an elector, which is actually quite complicated. And I know the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has decided to have a whole campaign on this running across the country, making sure students get to vote, because it's actually quite a complicated process to, for an individual to register. And the onus is on them to make sure got their vote.
Tony, I'm sure you're aware, but the Tories are looking to actually effectively almost wipe the electoral register clean. It's anticipated that something in the region of 2 million voters may drop off of the electoral register, not realizing that they've been dropped off, and may find themselves, for example, in the next round of local elections, which will come up in May, that they're no longer eligible to vote.
That would be certainly interesting, and another kind of gerrymandering. Also, boundary changes that are happening. So lots going on in the world of electoral fraud, and certainly Tower Hamlets. I would suggest, if anyone's interested, you know, whenever you're hearing this, look up them on the internet and see what's the latest there, because there's definitely been a hotbed for this. All sorts of different techniques being used to fix elections, all sorts of fictitious people voting, that kind of thing. But anyway, let's move on to talk a bit about fracking, because I know you've been very much involved in that campaign, and also had quite a busy week, Ian, involved in trying to fight bailiffs, etc. So can you just take us through your involvement in fracking in a nutshell, but then also what's been happening just over the last week or so?
Okay, well, I really picked up this cause in a big way after the moratorium was lifted in December 2012. I mean, it actually coincided. I'd just been out to Australia. I'd taken a trip up into the gas fields of southern Queensland. It is a horrendous experience to go into the gas fields of southern Queensland. I mean, the magnitude of the devastation there, the contamination, the impact on the communities there is unbelievable. It's beyond most people's bounds of comprehension, because you know we have nothing like this in this country on that kind of scale. In my first visit there in 2012, I was not bragging, but making the observation that, you know, at least we had a moratorium in place in the UK, thanks to Quadrilla drilling and fracking a well in the Fylde just outside Blackpool at Priest Hall, which had triggered a number of seismic events, two of which were quite significant. One on April the 1st, 2011, which was 3.5 on the Richter scale. And then another one on May the 27th, which was 2.7. So not tsunami inducing events, but nonetheless enough to cause minor internal damage, not structural damage, but internal damage to something like about 80 odd properties in the area. Well, I literally landed back from my trip out to Australia, and within a few days, David Cameron effectively lifted the moratorium. Now, I did have a suspicion that this might be the case, because literally a week or so earlier, I got word that Lord John Brown, who was at the time David Cameron's energy advisor, had also sort of floated the prospect of the moratorium being lifted to the world's press. And, you know, obviously when there wasn't a serious reaction, obviously Cameron felt empowered to lift the moratorium. Well, basically, I cancelled all my plans for 2013, and I put together a 63-day tour around the country. So I visited 63 locations around the country to sow the seeds, to try and stimulate people's own curiosity, to take a look at what this industry would mean for their community if it took a foothold. And I knew I had to finish that tour by mid-July, because I knew that Quadrilla were looking to get into a well site at Borkham in Sussex, somewhere around about the latter part of July. Well, it turned out that they actually moved on to the Borkham site on the 26th of July of 2013. And I think most of your listeners are probably aware, because you know, it had massive national news coverage. And over the bank holiday weekend, you know, there was the Reclaim the Power groups came down, and Caroline Lucas was arrested. So, you know, it got a lot of attention, and Quadrilla weren't able to do what they wanted to do at Borkham, because they basically ran out of time, because they had to be off that well site by September 28th. So then the campaign then moved north to Barton Moss in Manchester with a company called iGas, where iGas had permission to drill an exploratory, a deep exploratory well to some 10,000 feet. And that campaign kicked off in late November of 2013 and ran right through until early April of 2014. And that was, again, a full-on campaign. It didn't get the national media coverage that Borkham had had, but it certainly got a lot of coverage in the Northwest. And obviously it raised a lot of awareness about this whole issue in that area of the country. And then from there, we went over to Crawberry Hill in East Yorkshire, where the Humberside Police had made it very clear that they were not going to facilitate any form of peaceful protest, which meant that we had to get creative. So we actually built a wooden structure in front of the gate on private land, which was ungated, but we built a castle, effectively preventing Rathlin from entering onto that well site. And that castle was there for 3 months before Rathlin initiated legal proceedings to evict the castle. Well, I was one of 4 people who challenged that eviction, and the judge ruled against us. We were actually seeking the hearing to be moved from London to Hull, but the judge ruled against us. And ultimately, about £150,000 in costs were awarded against us. And my share of that apparently runs to about £37,000 at the moment. Well, the High Court bailiffs eventually came and demolished the castle. The campaign then sort of still stayed in the area on the grass verge, but then a loophole in the Road Traffic Act was used to remove the camp on the grounds of safety. But interestingly, the local community stepped up to the plate, because the itinerant protection community had been moved on. The local community, who by this time had become very well educated and understood the risks that you know, this industry brought along with it. And so they made life very difficult for Rathlin Energy. And literally, as we speak right now, Tony, Rathlin Energy are decommissioning that well at Crawberry Hill and have announced that they will not be returning to Crawberry Hill and will be returning the well site there to its former glory. So here we are 3 years on since the moratorium was lifted, and this country is still frack free. We have not had another well drilled and fracked. The greatest risk that we have at the moment is a company called Third Energy, which is 97% owned by Barclays Bank, who are looking to frack a well in North Yorkshire at a village just outside a village called Kirby Misperton. And this is a really remarkable location because it's less than, well, it's, in fact, it's exactly a kilometre from the entrance to Flamingo Land, which is North Yorkshire's biggest revenue earner in terms of tourism. So the community in North Yorkshire is very well informed, is highly mobilised, and I think it's going to be extremely difficult for North Yorkshire County Council to approve Third Energy's application. But, you know, we know that these councils are under enormous pressure. And, of course, we saw that earlier this year in Lancashire, where the British government was putting Lancashire County Council under enormous pressure to approve Quadrilla's application to drill and frack two wells in the Fylde, one at Rossica and one at Preston New Road. But the councillors stood up to that pressure and rejected both those applications. And now that goes to a full appeal, and that appeal process will start in February of next year. Now, you know, you're speaking to me from Bristol, and unfortunately, Somerset is not only facing a potential drama associated with Hinkley C power station, but the whole of the Somerset coast is part of the area that has been flagged up as potentially being licensed for unconventional gas exploitation as part of the recent 14th round license awards. Now, they haven't been confirmed yet, and my suspicion is that they probably won't be, but I think there's going to be a bit of bargaining going on with Somerset County Council, which is basically, you don't object to Hinkley and anything we want to do that's associated with Hinkley C, and we'll not pursue with the unconventional gas licenses. I think we're going to see a lot of Machiavellian machinations over the coming well, certainly year or so. But we have you know, a bit of serendipity on our side, because at the beginning of last year, you know, the price of oil was still rising, and it peaked in June of last year at about $115 a barrel. And certainly at $115 a barrel, the exploitation of unconventional hydrocarbons is, you know, a viable proposition. But the price of oil right now is under 45 bucks a barrel. And this is way below the point at which it has any viability. So one of the questions that, you know, we're having to ask is why, when in the rest of the world, the unconventional gas industry is effectively going into hibernation, why is it in this country that the British government is pursuing this agenda and is intent on literally fracking a significant chunk of the country? In fact, the whole of the Boland Shale, which goes right across from the Lancashire coast to the Yorkshire coast, is being targeted in this 14th round. And they're still talking about the potential for 10 to 15,000 wells, and that's being conservative, being drilled as Britain seeks to exploit its unconventional gas resources. Well, for some time now, I've suspected that there is a ulterior motive. And unfortunately, just last night, my suspicions were not just confirmed, but heightened, because last night I attended a presentation in Plymouth, which was put on by the Radioactive Waste Management Group based at Harwell, who are tasked with coming up with a solution for disposing of the 650,000 cubic meters of nuclear waste that we have in this country. And although they're putting forward a proposition that to build a deep geological disposal facility, which would take up something like about 12 square kilometers, they need a host community. And I don't think they're going to get that host community. And so I think that what is actually being perpetrated here is a push to drill deep wells, anything between sort of 6 and 10,000 feet deep, extract a bit of gas just for the sake of it. But then ultimately, the real revenue potentially will come from these boreholes being used for deep geological disposal of toxic nuclear waste. So this is something that, you know, I'm going to be working on through 2016, along with others, to these communities' awareness and obviously spread the awareness in terms of the potential threats of the unconventional gas industry, but also raise the awareness that the unconventional gas agenda may actually be the stalking horse to be able to get the nuclear waste deposited in these deep wells.
One of the things that's particularly surprising, Ian, is, I mean, you know, you're explaining there very well that the price of oil, price of energy generally in the world, makes fracking another unconventional gas, at least from the outsider's point of view, unviable. And yet this week we hear that there are rules being put through by the government, quite sure to what extent that they're publicising this, but I know The Guardian have got an article on it this week. The headline is "Ministers Accused of Trying to Sneak Through New Fracking Rules," and the reporter's Rowena Mason. That's Tuesday, 27th of October. And they're saying that that they're actually looking at making it actually very, very easy for these fracking firms to drill in national parks, sites of special scientific interest, and areas of outstanding natural beauty. I mean, what's the thinking there, do you think, since actually this is an almost unviable technology, and most of the country, of course, is not these protected areas. So why would they need to do that?
Well, I mean, it's a very good point. And of course, you know, prior to the election, just like David Cameron, you know, committed not to mess around with tax credits and then welched on that, you know, the Tory government prior to the election announced that it would not be looking to extract unconventional hydrocarbons from these areas. But in fact, they actually used a what's called a special instrument on Monday, which is a small committee. I mean, it was voted through at 10 votes to and 8 against. And now it goes into Parliament. And basically, this is how ridiculous it gets. The only way there will be a parliamentary vote on it is when it's raised in Parliament, if enough MPs literally just shout no. If nobody says anything, then it'll just be way through. But if enough MPs can be persuaded to shout no, then it has to go to a vote. I mean, people aren't aware of how these statutory instruments actually work and are undermining the, you know, what people perceive to be normal parliamentary process. So, I mean, people should be concerned because, you know, what is being proposed here is to literally implement an industry that has left a trail of devastation wherever it has managed to get a foothold around the world. It doesn't matter where you go in the US, whether it's in Dakota or Montana or Pennsylvania or Nebraska, Colorado, Texas, Louisiana, anywhere where they're exploiting unconventional gas, they have had problems which have led to the contamination of water, of soil, and of course the air. There are an increasing number of reports of the negative health impacts, particularly on young children. In Vernal in Utah, there's a report being published about the phenomenal rise in post and prenatal deaths, which coincidentally have manifested since the arrival of the unconventional gas industry into the area. You know, 3 years ago, the British government would trot out statements like, you know, there's no evidence of any contamination from anywhere. And they were relying on the fact that there weren't any scientific studies or weren't very many scientific studies at the time, and it was all anecdotal. But over the last 3 years, there's been some 500 academic reports published, which clearly demonstrate that the risks associated with this industry. And because, you know, we are a country that relies on the natural cycle for our water supply, and this industry requires absolutely phenomenal amounts of water. You know, in the US, they're taking the water from the Great River systems, the Mississippi, Missouri, Ohio rivers, and the Great Lakes. And then over in the west of the country, in Northern California, they are literally emptying some of the aquifers there, which have contributed to the massive droughts experienced in those areas this year. In Australia, they're sucking the water out of the Great Artesian Basin at a rate six times faster than it can naturally replenish. You know, we don't have any of these resources, you know, and if this industry got a foothold here, you know, we would be experiencing water shortages on a regular basis like, you know, we have never experienced before. It would be a lot more than just hose pipe bans. And that's before we even get on to, you know, the contamination issues. And a few months ago, we saw the problems arising when Lancashire had a problem with its water supply, which was cryptosporidium. And eventually it was announced that the contamination, and so people in a massive area of Lancashire had to boil their water before they used it. And eventually they said that it was due to a dead partridge being discovered in one of their pipelines. Well, you can multiply exponentially the kind of problems that would occur if this industry gets a foothold. So it's absolutely imperative that you know, people do their own research. And, you know, I always make the observation, Tony, I've never asked anyone to take anything I say at face value. You know, they don't need to. I when I go out and I talk on these subjects, I'm simply trying to stimulate people's own curiosity to look at this for themselves, to look at the impact that this industry has had wherever it's become established anywhere else in the world. And, you know, I released a documentary earlier this year from my most recent trip to Australia, which was almost exactly a year ago, last November. We released a documentary in April of this year, and it documents, you know, what's been going on in the UK over that period, but it also shows the magnitude of the impact on the communities in southern Queensland in Australia. And when I showed this film in Scotland, the chief operating officer, Tom Pickering of INEOS, and the INEOS corporate lawyer came to the screening at my invitation, because I'd been to their exhibition the night before, and I invited them to the screening. And the reason they brought the lawyer along, because I think they were hoping they were going to say something that would you know, drop me in it. But I made the observation. I said, it's great that we've got INEOS here. And I said, I encourage everybody in the audience to go to the INEOS events, to listen to what the INEOS representatives have to say, but then go away and do their own research. And I said, and I can absolutely promise that the one thing you will never hear anybody from INEOS or any other unconventional gas company or the UK government, the one thing you will never, ever hear them say is, don't take our word for it. Go away and do your own research, because they know very well that when people do start taking a look at this, they will very quickly realize that this is not something that they want, not just in their backyard, but in anyone else's backyard in this densely populated country of ours.
Now, from what you've been saying there, talking about the contamination of water supplies, the depletion of water supplies of aquifers, I mean, we've also heard, haven't we, about earthquakes. That was the reason originally that the whole fracking thing was stopped up in the northwest, and also the destruction of our national parks. There seems to be a kind of viciousness to this, Ian. It's not even necessary, and yet all these destructive forces seem to be almost denying the country. Side denying the earth to the population here in Britain. Would you go so far as to say these policies are vicious? Because it doesn't seem it's just the profit motive. It even seems to be more than that.
I would absolutely agree with you. I mean, it's vicious and it's aggressive. And, you know, I was in Manchester for the duration of the Tory conference, and I mean, what shocked me was the ring of steel that they put around the Tory conference. And yet when Jeremy Corbyn spoke in Manchester Cathedral on the Monday night there was hardly any police presence whatsoever. And there was, you know, certainly something in the region of 9,500 people there. There was about 7,000 outside and about 2,500 inside the cathedral, with hardly any police presence at all. And yet this ring of steel with snipers on the roofs, you know, protecting the Tories. And, you know, watching those people enter into the Tory conference, you know, there was something about their eye. It was almost like they were soulless. You know, there is a detachment. And sadly, what we've got is a bunch of politicians and their corporatist puppet masters that have absolutely no interest in anything other than their self-gratification in terms of, you know, material wealth. And literally, they will do anything. And the level of cognitive dissonance that one comes across, you know, whether it's the politicians, whether it's the people working for the corporations, or the people in academia, who in many cases are reliant on grants from these government departments or from the corporations for their funding. And there is just a total detachment, and it's cognitive dissonance.
The other side of all this is that really since the rise of the internet in the 1990s, people have right across the board have been challenging history. They've been challenging what we've been told in history books. I mean, there's that famous quote, isn't there, from Winston Churchill, Britain's wartime leader, saying, "History will be kind to me, I know, because I shall write it." History does seem to be being challenged in a way that I don't know if it ever has before in history. I mean, it's always been controlled. Printing has been controlled. Education and universities, to a certain extent, too, have been controlled. I wonder what you think about the new version of history, and if there's anything you point to that's starting to get some traction and gain ground as an alternative way of looking at our past.
Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, let's make the observation that it was Edmund Burke, I think, who said those who don't know history are destined to repeat it. And, you know, there's no question that there is a serious move to try to eradicate elements of history that are not supportive to, you know, current orthodoxy. I mean, people in the UK maybe aren't aware that George W. Bush, when he was in office, issued an edict that all school textbooks printed before 1986 had to be destroyed. And the reason that he was putting forward for that to happen was that the glue that was used in the binding, as it deteriorated with time, it gave off toxic fumes. And so they wanted to protect the population by destroying all pre-1986 textbooks. You know, in obviously, book burning, you know, goes all the way through history, whether it's the Library of Alexandria, whether it's the library at Gondishapur, whether it's the, you know, the Mayan scrolls and text, whether it's the deliberate destruction of the Sumerian Akkadian tablets, you know, with the invasion of Iraq and the destruction of the Iraqi Baghdad Museum. You know, all this is about trying to eradicate any opportunity for people to do their research into history, because, as you rightly say, the rise of the internet has given those people who are capable of independent thought the opportunity to go and you know, do a little bit of research for themselves. And depending on how far down the rabbit hole they want to go, it doesn't take very long for them to come to the realization that actually what they thought they knew is a complete crock. And, you know, the more they study, the more they research, they find that actually there are other possibilities that, and in more recent history, you know, people are beginning to realize that, particularly in your area, of course, that things like false flags have been used, you know, right from the days of the American-Spanish war, you know, right through, of course, to 9/11 and everything that's occurred since.
Is there anything you think which is a sort of single take home? It's almost like trying to rewrite the whole of history is impossible. But is there any one thing you point to which this has changed in our consciousness, this questioning much more history? It's almost like watching back, looking back into time and saying, well, hang on a minute, that's just not... Is there any one big take-home you've got from that, Ian?
Well, I mean, I think that there's no question the most significant catalyst was and still is 9/11. I mean, there were people that were aware of the sort of false flag agenda before that, but they were very much in the minority. And even in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the number of people who were actually questioning the official version of events was actually still very small. But over the last, you know, what is it now, 14 years, there's no question that, I mean, the number of people who actually believe the official version of events is quite probably less than those who think that something other than the official version of events occurred. And I'm not professing for one moment to say that, you know, I do know what occurred, but, you know, the one thing I do know is that what didn't occur is what is what was described by George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. So I think that's a massive trigger. But, you know, one of the things that I think that links everything that we've been talking about together here, in many ways, what the politicians are doing with their outrageous aggression, with their outrageous lack of compassion, you know, whether it's the attacks on the environment through things like unconventional gas exploitation, whether it's the attacks on the, you know, the lower end of society with the attempt to remove tax credits and, you know, create an underclass that's got almost no chance of clawing its way out of it. The attacks are coming from so many different angles that what's happening is that communities are coming together in a way like never before. And so, you know, one of the observations I would make is that what's actually happening right now on so many fronts is actually a gift. Because if this stuff wasn't happening, people would just be going about their, you know, normal day-to-day existence and just sort of going about their normal routine. But what's happening is more and more people are going are looking to say, you know, hang on a second, something's not right here. Something's seriously not right. And so there, today there are so many triggers that start people off on their journey. But and as you and I both know, you know, once this stuff is seen, it cannot be unseen.
Ian, just for our listeners' benefit, can you point us towards whereabouts we can find your work online and elsewhere?
Okay, well, I make all of my work as freely available as I possibly can. So, you know, I have my YouTube channel, and then there is the Alternative View YouTube channel, which has all of the presentations from the various conferences. And I think you've participated in at least one, if not two of them in the past. So my website is ianrcrane.com. And I put two weekly programs out from the studios of UK Column in Plymouth. So I have a show that goes out at 7:30 on a Mondays. It's up on YouTube the following day, called Humanity versus Insanity, where we cover, you know, a whole range of issues. And then at 9 o'clock on a Monday, the live show Fracking Nightmare goes out. So, I mean, obviously, that's all things fracking. And once again, those shows are up on YouTube the following day. So if you just search for either Humanity versus Insanity or Fracking Nightmare or Ian R. Crane, then, you know, you can stumble across my work.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Since the Jimmy Savile expose, many people have been talking about child sexual abuse. In fact, it's become much more acceptable to talk about many, many things that have been going on in Britain. For decades, suddenly, they're being exposed. And today, we talk to somebody who's from one of the organisations that's trying to deal with this. It's called the People's Tribunal. It's a collection of people who have themselves been sexually abused who are trying to run a tribunal of their own because they don't have much faith in the government's Goddard inquiry, which is being staffed by people from the Home Office, which is actually part of the allegations are against the Home Office itself. And so we hear now from Cheryl Corliss from the People's Tribunal about child stealing by the state.
I'm Cheryl Corliss. I was abused in the care system and I was just ignored. And we've already spoke about that on another show. But years later, I left an abusive relationship. It was worse than abusive. He was a monster. We'd already done a lot of time in prison already for violent crime, so everybody knew what he was.
Cheryl, I mean, it might sound like an obvious question, but how did you find yourself with someone like that?
When I was abused in the care system, I ran from care and I was homeless for a year. I lived on the streets for a year. I was only 17. And then I got pregnant and the father left me. And then I was 19. I was on my own with a new baby. I went in a bed and breakfast because I was still homeless. Like, they put me in a bed and breakfast as I had him. And he was in the bed and breakfast. He was 28. I was 19 and I was very vulnerable, really vulnerable. I was messed up from what had happened to me in care and living on the streets and everything. And he must have seen something in me because he came, do you know what I mean? And then just gradually just took control, and the violence, it just got worse and worse over the years. By the end of it, I was pregnant with our son, and he'd smashed me across every wall, going up the street, dragging me up the street by my hair. He'd be kicking me in the stomach because he didn't want the baby. He'd rape me. It was horrendous, and it ended up with me. I was in labour with our son, and I told him I was in labour. I had a contraction, and he came down, running downstairs and punched me in the head. So I ran to the phone box across the road, just to get away from him, really, and I ended up giving birth there in the telephone box.
So your partner at the time, did he stay with you after you'd had that child?
No, when I got out of hospital, he beat me up then, and that was it. I couldn't take anymore. I think my mental health, when I look back now I've had my mental health sorted, and I look back, it's pretty obvious I was having some sort of mental breakdown. I got rid of him. He made my life hell for about a year. He was always shouting through my letterbox, trying to get in, breaking in. Oh, it was awful. In this time, I started drinking heavily. I felt stronger when I was drunk. If I had a drink and he came round, then I'd fight him back and I wasn't scared of him. It was a twisted circle. But in this time, then it all started coming back about what had happened to me in care, and I started to think, like, maybe that was wrong. Maybe I didn't deserve that. Maybe I didn't deserve what he'd done to me neither. And I went to the social services and I told them that I think I've been abused in the care system. And it was just like, well, what can we do about it? It's a long time ago. Like, they just basically didn't want to know. And the next thing you know, I've got a social worker on my case.
So how long ago had it been when you told them?
I was 25 when I left him, so it would have been 8 years since I'd run from care.
Now, were some of the people still working in the care system that had abused you?
Oh, probably, yeah. My home had been shut down, the home where it happened, but they were all shuffled around the system, and it was just like they didn't believe me a bit. And as soon as I told them, then that's when they decided that my children needed to go on child protection.
So how did they actually do that? And how did they make the decision? And did they actually just come literally with the police or something and take children away from you?
No, because you have a child protection meeting where you've got about 20 professionals sat around a table, and it is so, how do I put it, it's really overwhelming and it's frightening. And I had these child protection meetings when I was in care, and so it's just throwing me back to there, do you know what I mean? And no matter what you say in a child protection meeting, they all agree with the social worker. So they all decided that my children needed to be on child protection. They hadn't needed to be on child protection while I was in a violent relationship. The police had told me they couldn't help me when I was in the violent relationship. I didn't get any help or support for that. And then they had them on child protection, and my ex-partner's still playing games with me and tormenting me and just terrifying me, basically.
So at this stage, how many children did you have and what ages were they?
I had three at this stage. One was 5, 3, and the baby in the phone box, he was one. It was when he got to 18 months old. They came round with the police one day and decided they were taking him. I didn't find out till much later, but the time he was on child protection, my ex-partner and all his family, they were ringing social services on me every chance they got, making complaints about me. So it was building a case up against me, do you know what I mean? Even though I hadn't done anything, they was ringing up and saying, well, Cheryl's done this. And so then they ended up taking my children.
So what accusations were they making against you?
I was a risk of future emotional harm and neglect. When he got to court, I just kept thinking all the time, every day, like, well, this can't go ahead. This can't go ahead. Do you know what I mean? The truth will come out. And then at the end of it, they gave two of my children to my violent ex. Even though he had a 9-year criminal record, I'd been in hospital with broken bones off him. The police had been called out numerous times because of what he did to me. They still gave two of my children to him. and my eldest child was forced adopted. And the day that it was forced adopted, even now, it still hurts me now to think about it now. Like, he's a grown man now, but it was like the judge had given me the death penalty. And so, as she did it, I heard this screaming, and it was me, and I'm on the floor, and I didn't even know how I got there. And all the social workers and barristers and everyone were all high-fiving each other on a job well done because my son had been adopted in it. And it was just awful. And then they just left me. As soon as they took the children, they just left me. They had a psychological report saying that I was delusional because I was saying that I'd been abused in care. Because I was delusional, apparently, about the abuse in care, then I was delusional about my partner hitting me, and I was the violent one, they were saying. And my son went for forced adoption, and the other two went to him. He let me see him for 1 hour a month. That was it. And I know that he wasn't a good father to them, but no matter how many complaints I made, social services did what I know. It was like, why was it always my abusers? Why did my abusers always win? Do you know what I mean? It must have been something that was wrong with me. I spent the next few years just basically getting drunk all the time. I had a massive drink problem. And then I met somebody else, and he was violent as well. And I got pregnant off him, but then I escaped while I was pregnant. And I thought, no, this is it. I've stopped drinking. I thought, no, I'm going to have this baby. And then I think I got to about 6 weeks pregnant. The eldest had been in adoption for 3 years. And then I get a knock at the door, and it's the social worker that had taken him. And she said, the adoption hasn't worked, he's back. And I said, what do you mean the adoption hasn't worked? I said, you took him off me because you said that I couldn't give him a stable life. And she said, well, he's back and he wants to come home. So we're going to start this program to bring him home. And the following year, when I had my son on the 11th of May, and on the 12th of May, my eldest son, who was then 12, he came home forever. And all the assessments that they'd done in the first time when they took the children, this time they came back and it was all perfect. And I was a fantastic mother, and I had a high IQ and just totally amazing. And then he come home and there was no problems. And then I met my husband. We had another child. We was happy. The children were loved. They were protected. They were lovely kids. The eldest ended up leaving home when he was 16. He came back from adoption with a very, very lot of problems, a hell of a lot of problems. And social services just left him there. They didn't offer him any support. They didn't offer me any support. They put that much into splitting us up. But then when it came to putting us back together, there was nothing there. And then we ended up, I was pregnant with my fourth child with my husband. I had a 5-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 2-year-old. And I was pregnant with my fourth child, and my husband left me. And I ended up giving birth at home again. I had one of them stupid births again, and I ended up giving birth on my own at home with the kids there. So then social services got involved again. And this was 5 years after my eldest had come home from adoption. And then this time it went through court again, and it was exactly the same as the first time. The second time, when I got all the good assessments, and they were telling me that I was good and this, and he had a high IQ and everything, that had all been forgotten. The court didn't want to hear any of that. All they wanted to hear was the bad ones that they'd used when they took the first children.
So did they decide that they wanted to take this new baby and leave you with the other children that you were okay to look after?
No, they took them all. They ended up, they got involved when the baby was new, and then they put me on child protection, and oh my God, for that 11 months, I did everything and everything backwards just to keep hold of my children. They would come round 9:15 every single morning, and by then, I'd had one child at school, dropped him off at school, I'd had another one, dropped him off at nursery, and then I was back and I'd fed and dressed all the babies and everything. Everything was ready, and if they came in and the breakfast pots hadn't been washed yet, or the bedding hadn't been made yet, do you know, because I'm rushing out for school. He was like, you're a pathetic mother. You're a pathetic mother. Look at the state of this house. You don't deserve your children. And they bullied me in every single sense of the world for 11 long months. And then eventually they took him. And then when they took him, what I didn't know at the time, I refused to sign anything this time. I said, no, I'm not signing anything. You're not tricking me with anything. And I refused to sign anything from day one. And I've got witnesses to prove that. And then when I got my paperwork back last year, they've got a forged signature saying that I signed them in care. And they was in care for 8 months before any court proceedings were started. And because they needed the extra evidence. So as soon as they'd taken them, they gave me a psychological assessment. And this time in the psychological assessment, they agreed that I had been raped in the care system. But because I'd been raped in the care system, I was at risk of future emotional harm and neglect. And it was just so horrendous. And the social worker that it was a team. You had the social worker manager and the area manager. And everyone I tried to complain to, they was all laughing at me and saying, well, any of your complaints go in the shredder. And I kept saying, they're working as a team. And everyone was going, no, you're being paranoid. You're being paranoid. As soon as they took my children after my first contact, they made sure that I waited. They told me to wait because they wanted a word with me. The social worker that had took my children, they presented it with a bouquet of flowers on a job well done. And then 3 months later, I find out that these same people that were all working together that I was told I was being paranoid about all opened a new business for independent social workers where they get money from the court to gather evidence for other people. And
Cheryl, what's that? Is that company still around? What's it called?
Yeah, it's called Heather Card Associates.
So can you spell that for us?
Heather, H-E-A-T-H-E-R, C-A-R-D, Associates.
So anyway, how did you deal with having to go to court? And did you have a solicitor, that sort of thing?
I had a solicitor, and this is where I realised that the solicitors in family court, they get the same amount of pay whether you win or lose. So they can't be bothered. They want more customers coming off the social services. So they do what the social services want, basically. My social worker, she just didn't like me. And she made it very clear. And I've got my paperwork now. I got all my paperwork back last year. And in it, my social worker, when they're talking about a care order, my solicitor, when they're talking about a care order, is saying, can we get this job over and done with fast? I need to get my car into the garage because I've got her going on holiday tomorrow. And the Guardian of Lighton, he's supposed to be the children's solicitor. He's supposed to be the children's voice. And he goes to the court and he says what he thinks is right for the children. I met him outside the court and I said, have you met my children? They're lovely children, aren't they? And he says, no, Cheryl, I haven't met them. I don't need to meet them and I won't be. And then he went into the courtroom, amended that, they went for forced adoption. And now two of them have been forced adopted by a member of the team that took my children. The other two, they're now 10 and 11. They haven't been allowed to see any family member for the last 4 or 5 years. They haven't been adopted. They're in long-term foster care. But the court put them on a placement order, which means that I've got no rights as a parent to contact. And last year, last November it was, I went to a meeting and they said, we're going to take the placement order off and we're going to resume contact. The children have wrote you letters. We will be sending them to you. And we'd like you to write back. And I'm still waiting now for these letters and for this court hearing to start. And until they remove this placement order, I can't even have contact with them two little boys that have been stuck in the system, not seeing each other or anybody else, because they wanted the little two adopted.
So do you feel like you've had your children stolen?
Yeah, definitely. It was a planned attack. It was a totally planned attack. The way they bullied me is like my next door neighbour, like she was only 17 at the time. She was doing a childcare course at college. And she witnessed it herself, and that stopped her wanting to go into childcare. She witnessed it herself, and she says, I can't believe it. And my little niece, I used to childmind my little niece. She was only 7 at the time. She's hiding in the dining room one day because she'd heard how nasty these social workers were with me. And she's hiding in there, and she's hearing them saying that my little girl is ideal for adoption. why do people like me have children like her? Because my daughter was, she's a very beautiful child. And that still haunts my little niece now. Do you know what I mean? She's 13 now, and it still hurts her head now. And the cousins, and they've not been allowed to see any of the cousins, and it's affecting the cousins on this side. And it's just so wrong. Why put them in a system that has already failed me? My abusers have got my children, and I can't do anything about it. And it's like being in a nightmare with my eyes pinned open and being forced to watch this nightmare ongoing, and there's nothing I can do about it. I've been to 25 different solicitors I tried to take my case on, and not one of them will take my case on. We don't want to know. Nobody wants to know, because family court is secret court. Nobody knows what happens.
Just go through your children and when you last saw them and what that contact was like.
My last contact with the adopted two, my little boy was three, and he asked the social worker, no, he asked me if I'd marry him. The social worker was stood there, and he asked me if I'd marry him. And I said, I can't get married, sweetheart, I'm your mummy. And he says, yes, but if I marry you, then I can come and live with you. And that's just stuck in my head every time. Do you know what I mean? That's all I can think about, is that little poor little boy. And he used to pick twigs up off the floor, and he'd point at the tree and he'd go, that's a mummy tree. And then he picked the twig up and he said, that's an Alfie tree. That was his name. And it just breaks my heart. My little girl was only two. I've got five sons and two daughters. My second daughter is my second eldest. So I'd had another four sons before my daughter. So she was very, very much wanted and cherished. And it was just horrendous. And my little boys, the last time I seen them, the foster carer made up a story and said I was shouting abuse at her when I was coming out of the contact centre. And I'd never said a word to her. I was on the telephone. I hadn't said a word to her. I hadn't even looked at her. It was hard enough seeing my children drive away anyway. And it's just some of the foster carers. I'm not saying all of them, because I have seen some amazing foster carers. There is some really amazing ones. But some of them, they think that they're better than you. And they will do anything to make things difficult for you, because it's hard work for them. They've got to come in from school, then go out to contact. They don't want to be doing that. They get an extra £500 per child per week to look after that child. But not if it disrupts their routine. The majority of them only do it for the money. It's a cruel, wicked, horrible system. And this future risk of emotional harm, 75% of children in the care system in the UK now have been taken for the future risk of emotional harm neglect. Nothing has happened to them. That's a credible cause to go to court. The judge just ignores everything you say and just does exactly what the social worker's asking to. They don't even listen to what you're saying. They never get your children's name right when you're in court. It's just horrible. And then because you're shouting and you're getting upset, you're getting called volatile. But what do you want us to do? Do you know what I mean? I did everything and more. I really did. And them children did not deserve being taken off me. They didn't, not at all. And they've gagged me as well. The court gagged me and told me I'll go to prison if I tell my story. Well, I'm not bothered. Send me to prison, and then maybe then we'll get to proper court, Crown Court, and then we can get my case out in the open and we can talk about it.
Cheryl, what do you put it down to? I mean, what's behind? What's the motivation for this treatment of you?
There's profit in the care system. I believe that we were left to be abused when we were in the care system to keep the wheel turning of the system in the future when we have children, I believe. So then that was an excuse for us to lose our children. There's profit in it. There's so many social workers now got multi-million pound fostering agencies and social workers, I don't know if it's true, but I've seen it in a lot of papers, they get bonuses for if they get enough adoptions for that month. And so they don't go after the broken children. The broken children, they're not going to make any money in adoption, because they don't want a broken child. An adopter wants a perfect little baby that's going to match the little house and the handbag. They don't want, do you know what I mean? It's the abused children. That's what the care system was made for. But they're just ignored in favour of the pretty children, the ones they can sell. I thought it was just me. I really thought for a long, 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 long time, I just thought my face doesn't fit. I must have done something wrong in a previous life for all this to happen to me. And then I found support groups on Facebook, and it's thousands. There's thousands of parents like me all screaming to be heard with basically identical stories. It's just horrendous. The amount of ex-care children that their children are in care now is ridiculous. I mean, if that care system was so good that they've got to take our children for the future risk of harm, and it was so good, then why is that care system failing so many people?
So what do you think needs doing? If you were sitting in the, I don't know, David Cameron's chair, and you say, right, we're going to change things, what needs changing?
I think the whole care system needs reforming, the whole thing. I think they've got it wrong. It's like, in my family personally, it's been going on for 70 years. My mother was a care child in the Irish residential schools, and then me, and it's like every generation, it's three generations in my family that have been broken by the care system.
Didn't you try to break out of that?
Pardon?
Didn't you try to break out of that cycle?
Yeah. Yeah. I tried with all my heart, and it just wasn't good enough. It's like, once you're a care kid, it just feels like you've got a big red stamp on your file. And nothing you can do. Nobody wants to listen to you. The psychiatric reports they give for the court, they just say what the court wants them to say. And it's proved that in my notes, where when my eldest son came back, the psychological report was saying I had no issues. And nobody's ever told me. I didn't know until 3 years ago what mental health issues were. And it was only when I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar, which was probably caused by what I've been through, that I realised that, oh, maybe I've had mental health issues all this time and the tablet could have helped me. But nobody bothered to tell me. It was just loads of jargon, and it's like, well, the psychotherapist with this case, she said, I recommend the children come home, but 6 months of therapy for Cheryl first, and then 6 months of therapy after that with Cheryl and the children. And the social worker sat there and said, but we're not paying for that. If you want that, Cheryl, you'll have to pay it yourself. This was the therapy that my doctor said I'd imagined, because he'd never heard of it. It was called schema-focused therapy. And I couldn't get it anywhere. Nobody would give it to me. And the social workers were saying they weren't paying for it, even though the psychotherapist had said it, because of what happened to me in care. So they owed me that. And they didn't. No, they just went, no, we'll go for adoption instead. And I wasn't given a chance at all. It was horrible.
What motivates the social workers that have been, you know, doing high fives when your kids get taken away, get bouquets of flowers? That's what motivates them?
The bonuses they get. Is they're going to get a promotion because they're getting the kids in to adopt, and that's what the government drive is at the minute, isn't it? It's for the adoption drive. And the adoptions are now for the government. It's Martin Neary, and he was deputy head at Medensley. That's another horror story in itself, what happened to them boys. And he didn't notice all them thousands of boys being abused. But the government think he's the perfect man to have a say in adoption.
So who's this and where?
Martin Neary. He was the CEO in Medensley. Medensley was a boys' hostel. Not sure where it was. If you Google it, you find it. But it's horrendous, horrendous abuse happened to young boys there. Horrendous. And Martin Neary was the governor there. And then he went from there. He got a job as CEO for Barnardo's. And then he's gone from there, and now his adoptions are. But he didn't notice all these boys being abused. Is that really somebody that should be making judgments on people's children? It's like, our children are ours. The government own our children, basically.
So how do you survive day-to-day, Cheryl? Are you on your own there?
Yeah. I don't. I won't have a relationship. After my marriage broke up, I'm not even trying again. I'm very close to my sister-in-law and my nieces and nephews, and they keep me going. And the People's Tribunals kept me busy these last couple of years. And but since they went, basically, I've just been an activist, and I've just tried to get the truth out in any way I can, in any ways. I went into Westminster Abbey, I think it was 2 years ago, and I squirted some paint on a statue. I got heavily fined for it, but I just wanted to get in the newspapers, because I thought, if I get in the newspapers, then I'm on Google. If I'm on Google, then if the kids try and find me, they can see that I'm here and I'm still fighting. I've tried going to all the journalists. I've tried every single way, and nobody wants to talk about this hidden secret of forced adoption. It's exactly what the nuns were doing, but social services have taken it over. It's still wrong. It's still immoral, and it's still happening. And I just feel so lucky that I never got a baby took at newborn. I've seen so many people, they're waiting at the bottom of the bed while they're giving birth to catch the baby and take it off them. And I don't think I'd have survived that. I don't think I'd have got through that. Say somebody lost a child, like, because people, they lose a child for some stupid reasons. But if you lost a child and somebody adopted that child, if that parent gets pregnant again, the adopters get first choice on whether they want that child. So if the adopter decides they want that child, then as soon as that child's born, it's taken.
That was Dialect for this week, and I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks very much to our guests. That was Ian R. Crane and Cheryl Corliss from the People's Tribunal, and also to studio engineer Dave Pozanko. Please join us at the same time next week, and we're online at dialectradio.co.uk. See you next week, and bye for now.